It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The statewide coalition End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin, it tracks a disturbing rise in domestic violence deaths in our state as federal funding to help survivors is drying up. We examine the implications, and you can join the conversation. Call in with a question, share comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Jenna Gormel is Public Policy Director at End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. Jenna, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Yes, and Monique Minkins is here, the Coalition's Executive Director. Monique, welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Monique, let's start with you. You're anticipating a 70% reduction in federal funding for victim services here in Wisconsin. How would this impact End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin?
You know, it's bigger than End Abuse, and thinking that we support the programs around the state, and it's going to affect survivors, victims and survivors. I think about our homicide report that came out last fall, and there were 96 homicides for 2022. And with funding cuts coming and the homicide rates continuing to rise, that gives lots of concern. And so what the cuts will do is it will affect staffing at programs around the state. It will affect their operations. They may have to, some may close because they rely on that money to operate. Some people have more funding from that fund than others. And so this is really big in that it's going to affect a lot of people. We've had, like I said, 96 homicides in 2022. People are going to die, and that is a great concern for us.
Mm. Jenna, what stands out to you in terms of this drop in funding and what it would mean for services in the state?
I think what stands out to me always, or what feels really stark, is just the numbers in some ways, right? The stories are obviously very powerful, and we can talk about that as well. But I think when you understand the magnitude of the cuts, so we're talking about a 70% cut in funding, and that is going to happen in October, which is just going to be an absolute cliff for domestic violence and sexual assault programs all across the state, who, you know, right now the Department of Justice administers about $44.5 million per year for programs all across the state. And they're projecting that in October, that is going to drop down to $13.5 million. So a 70% cut is just, it's enormous, and it's almost unimaginable the impact that it's going to have for not only domestic violence programs and sexual assault programs, but as Monique said, the survivors across the state who are in dire need of life-saving services that they provide.
Jenna, can you step back for a moment and explain the Victims of Crime Act of 1984, what this fund does and you know, how it's distributed to Wisconsin?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Victims of Crime Act it's essentially a non-taxpayer source of funding that supports thousands of victim service providers across the entire United States. And that's funded by monetary penalties that are associated with federal convictions and certain criminal settlements at the federal level. And so basically, the deposits that go into the Crime Victims Fund kind of fluctuate year on year because it is relying upon these federal crimes being prosecuted and that money being placed into the Crime Victims Fund. And so what's been happening with the Crime Victims Fund is that there was a change to the way that the money was going into the fund, and we've seen a decline over time. And we thankfully had a fix to the fund that happened in 2021, the VOCA fix, which meant that there we're beginning to see increased deposits because monetary penalties from these deferred prosecution and non-prosecution agreements are now going back into the fund instead of the general treasury.
Okay.
So that gets to, yeah, that money gets distributed all across all of our states. But we, because of the declines in deposits over, you know, several years, the appropriators can only release a certain amount of money to states, and that's why we're seeing this huge cut.
Jenna Gormel there is End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin Public Policy Director. Monique Minkins is with us, who is the organization's executive director, as we discuss funding for victim services. You can call in with questions and comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. So meanwhile, here in Wisconsin, there is a bill in the state legislature proposing increasing state aid to fund victim services. And the bill recently had a public hearing in the assembly. Jenna, is there bipartisan support for the bills?
Yeah, absolutely. There is. We have strong bipartisan support in the Senate and the assembly, which is really fantastic. That one of the champions of the bill, the author of the bill, Senator James, and he's been fantastic in really pushing this bill forward. I think one of the things we want to always communicate is that domestic violence and sexual assault is not a partisan issue, right? It happens to everyone, regardless of political affiliation. And I think the Wisconsin State Legislature also really sees that as well.
Monique, the bill would increase funding for domestic abuse services by $7 million in this budget year and $18 million in the next. Would that amount be enough for the needs and services in Wisconsin?
You know, it's helpful. I don't know if it will be enough. We have programs who are already at a deficit, or not a deficit, but struggling to meet the needs of the people that they serve. Excuse me, and thinking that
Monique, are you there? I think we're having some trouble reaching Monique Minkins. I'm wondering, Jenna, you know, would the reductions in this Federal Crime Victims Fund, would, you know, that creates some sort of crisis for domestic violence services and prevention? Do we need, a stimulating state funding here in order to carry on these programs?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's one of the things that happens when I used to work at a domestic violence program for 5 years. So I've also been in a program that has experienced cuts, and I've seen the effect of that firsthand. And what it means is that when you'll have things like staff layoffs, you'll have a lack of funds to do programming like prevention programming, which we know is obviously so critical. You need both things, right? You need crisis intervention to support survivors who are experiencing chronic violence right now. And you also need prevention programming so that we can, you know, solve the problem and kind of transform the conditions that allow violence to happen in the first place. And when you have cuts to funding, programs are forced to really think about, okay, what is the absolute critical services that we can provide? And the first thing that falls off is usually prevention efforts, and then also sexual assault advocates get left behind and get dropped, and that is a huge problem. And we want to make sure that survivors that are coming to domestic violence and sexual assault programs have all of the resources that they need, and that they actually know that the programs exist. Because another thing that, you know, programs can shut down, or they're not able to advertise themselves in their communities because they're just so focused on meeting the need and they're overwhelmed. And a lot of survivors don't even know that these programs are out there to help them.
That these services even exist. Jenna
Exactly.
Gormel is with us, who is Public Policy Director at End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. Monique Minkins is Executive Director. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Domestic violence is ending the lives of Wisconsinites at record levels, and those figures are from a statewide coalition of advocates at End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. We discuss interventions and funding for survivor services with the organization. Jenna Gormel leads public policy, and Monique Minkins is executive director. Call in with a question. You can share thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Monique, let's examine 96. Your organization reports that 96 people died from domestic violence-related deaths in 2022. Do you see common patterns among these deaths?
Most definitely. The 96, the majority were in the process of leaving or have left. There are all the risk factors that are common, where there was either a threat to kill, there was stalking, the use of a weapon, strangulation, sexual assault, or obsessive jealousy. One thing I noticed about the report is that we often see, or in the past, there's been more of a concentration of homicides in urban areas, where here 47 were in rural areas and 49 were in urban areas, and so they occurred in 25 counties. And so it doesn't matter where you live or who you are, anyone could fall victim.
Are there persistent, like, racial and gender disparities that show up in the numbers?
Yes. Not Hispanic Black women and American Indian, Alaskan Native women are killed at nearly three times the rate of non-Hispanic white women. And as you said, they also face economic disparities. That's huge. You know, we've seen it. I think about recently where there was a homicide in Milwaukee over the weekend, and it was a Black woman. I think that police play a great role in our community, and there are some people that are not comfortable calling the police. And it's because of they don't want their partner arrested. They just want the violence to stop. They're concerned about being arrested. There are many, many factors that go into it. And so, yes, that's our homicide report.
Let's take a call now. Susan is with us in Westfield. Susan, hi, go ahead.
Hi, I was just listening to your program, and it really struck me. I'm from California, and 2 decades ago, I left an abusive marriage. If I had got the help I did, I wouldn't be here now. I'm sorry.
Take your time.
It's so important. It is so important. When I left my marriage, I went to Weave, and I got a lot of help, and I got help from the courts. And if that help hadn't been there, if I hadn't been able, you know, to have people just by my side, to have a victim witness advocate, to have people that just guided me through, you know, everything, because it really doesn't matter how intelligent you are, how much you think you know, or anything going through something like that. You have to, having people by your side, and to take away the aid that women need just kind of horrifies me, honestly.
Susan, thank you for sharing your story. Jenna, what do you hear in Susan's story?
Well, thank you, Susan, for sharing. I appreciate you calling in. I think what I hear in Susan's story is the story of survivors that are all across the state, survivors that I worked with, survivors who testified at the public hearing last week, is that the situation that they, you know, you're in is is so horrifying, and just having an advocate there with you who's able to navigate that so many complex systems that you now have to face is life-saving and life-changing. And I think, you know, Susan said it, you know, herself, it's like she might not have been here had she not had an advocate. And that is the case. That's what we're seeing, is that when folks don't have access to supportive services, we're seeing an increase in homicides. You know, the homicides went up by 20% in 1 year. And that's because people don't have access to those life-saving supports. So thank you so much, Susan, for calling in and really kind of expressing how supportive it was to have that help.
We're talking about funding for survivor services here in Wisconsin. Jenna Gormel there is, and Domestic Abuse Wisconsin's public policy director. Monique Minkins with us, executive director. Call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Kevin in Janesville is here. Kevin, hi.
Hi, good morning. It's just such a heart-wrenching situation from beginning to unfortunate ends, but has any thought, plans, funding going toward community outreach and education in high schools or even middle schools? The relationships, the violence is just so normalized in media and society, and we head it off before it takes root. Thank you.
Kevin, thank you. And a note here, Teen Dating Violence Awareness Month is underway. Monique, go ahead.
Yeah, Teen Dating Violence Month is underway. Our teen summit, we have an annual teen summit, and this year it's April 28th to the 30th. People can register on our website, and I think about, or our website, endabusewisconsin.org. And thinking about what Kevin was saying, and our youth, we always talk about how someday they're going to change the world. I remember saying that to a youth and hearing her say that we're already here. And they are powerful. And when I think about the Teen Summit and what Kevin was saying about going upstream and being proactive, the Teen Summit is facilitated mostly by youth. Most of the programs or the sessions will be facilitated by youth. And they have stories to tell, and they have lots of solutions for us that it's important that we listen to them. And so I agree with you, or with Kevin, in that prevention is really important. Unfortunately, we spend quite a bit of time looking at doing intervention, and prevention would tell you, or even have an opportunity to stop and looking at historical violence and trauma, childhood trauma, family trauma, all of those things that are important to examine to understand why people do what they do, I think is really important. And so Kevin hit it right on the nail.
Jenna, how common is dating violence among teens?
I think, if I'm remembering correctly, 1 in every 5 teen will experience domestic violence.
Wow.
So it is, it's a huge problem. And I think, to Monique's point, one of the reasons why the Teen Summit is so important, and thank you, Kevin, for highlighting this, is that, you know, gender stereotypes really play a huge role in the perpetuation of domestic violence. And, you know, those stereotypes obviously arise from our cultural values. And what one thing we want to do is try and kind of break those stereotypes down and not leave them unexamined, because we see, you know, research shows that there is a significant relationship between really strict masculine gender roles and intimate partner violence. So we want to really break these gender stereotypes down, you know, like stereotypes like women are more submissive, men are more aggressive, like, and break all of that down. And when you do that, the research shows that folks leave those spaces with different views of seeing the world, different ways of seeing themselves. And it is a really strong preventative measure for domestic violence and sexual assault.
Monique, in our last few moments together, there might be someone who could say, you know, it could never happen to me. It would happen to someone else. Who is victim services not reaching?
I think victim services is reaching whoever's not aware, people that are isolated. You know, there are so many avenues and so many resources out there, and it's a matter of whether people are aware of them or not. Yeah. And if they're not, then it's really hard. If they don't reach out for help.
Well, Monique and Jenna, thank you so much for your work. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Jenna Gormel, Public Policy Director and Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. Monique Minkins, the Executive Director. If you or someone you know is experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 800-799-7233. You're listening to The Morning Show on the IDS Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We meet two athletes from Eau Claire who carry on the Chippewa Valley's long ski jumping tradition as they compete internationally. Call in with a question. You can share comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have two-time Olympian Ben Loomis, who is on the U.S. National Nordic Combined Team that unites ski jumping and cross-country skiing. Ben, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm excited to be here and look forward to talking to everyone today.
Yes, and Andrew Erlob here as well on the U.S. National Ski Jumping Team and was a silver and bronze medalist at last year's U.S. National Championships. Andrew, welcome.
Hi, good morning. Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yes. Well, Andrew, let's start with you. You compete around the world on the national ski jumping team. Where has competition taken you so far this year?
Yeah, that's a really good question.
Where have I been?
we started our season, Thanksgiving weekend. So that would have been the last weekend in November. Yeah, we've been every weekend since then, pretty much in a different country. Norway, Finland, and then some places around Central Europe. So Germany, Austria, Switzerland. And this past weekend, we had a home event in Lake Placid, New York.
Oh, Lake Placid, home of an Olympics many, many decades ago, right?
Yes, 1980.
1980, I believe. Yes. I've been to Lake Placid. So, you know, how do you calm your nerves before a jump? I mean, what is it like to fly through the air as a ski jumper?
Well, I've actually been ski jumping since I was 5 years old. And so now it's just kind of hardwired into my brain. The nerves are not so much scary nerves, but more competition nerves, you know, kind of the excitement you get before competing. And so, yeah, I mean, it's exciting. It's an amazing feeling to fly through the air. And yeah, we have a blast.
Ben Loomis, you're a member of the U.S. National Nordic Combined Team. So you've got the ski jumping and the cross-country skiing that converges there. How is the season going so far?
Yeah, so I do Nordic Combined, which is, you know, a little bit different than what Andrew does. So obviously I have the ski jumping component as well as the cross-country side of thing. Obviously two very different sports, but we both share the fact that we're both ski jumpers. But so far, I've had a really good season for me. Been really happy with it. You know, like Andrew, I've been traveling around the world, mostly in Europe, obviously. It's been a really good season for me. I actually just flew home yesterday from Estonia, so back home in the U.S. for a little bit before going back to Europe for the final few World Cups of the season.
Wow, that must be really busy. Like, what is your training regimen like that when you're on the road so much, far from home, you know, going from one competition to the next?
It's busy for sure. Obviously, the travel adds a lot of kind of a different aspect to the training. And it's important to, like, stay healthy and especially during the season, staying healthy and kind of being ready physically, mentally. So, of course, training a lot in the winter as well during the competition season, but it's a little bit different. It's more day-to-day training and just doing what you can to be ready for the next weekend. So it's still very much very busy training, but it's more quality over quantity when it comes to training in the winter. And then going back to like spring and summer, that's when we're putting in a lot of time, both the ski jumping side and the cross country side of training.
Does it take a different mental focus to both ski and jump in the same event?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think that they're obviously very different sports, and you have to take a different approach, in my opinion. So ski jumping is more about, in my opinion, and kind of how I approach it, of being calm and relaxed and like really focused. Cross country skiing is more about, you know, kind of having that energy and that fire and being able to like push yourself. So they're definitely very different. You have to approach them differently. And of course we do both those, both in training and competition days, we do both the ski jumping and cross country side of things on the same day. So there's always that kind of like mental switch between the two of being able to change your mind and change your approach for each event.
Andrew, what kind of structure do you get from competing on the U.S. national team for ski jumping? What is that like as being part of that team?
So we have, let's see, four guys on the national team for mm-hmm. ski jumping.
Mm-hmm.
And during these summer months, we are all together, usually in Lillehammer, Norway. So we do our daily training throughout the summer, maybe go to a couple competitions in the summer just to kind of see where we are compared to the rest of the world and see how our training is going. So we spend a lot of time in Norway during the summer. And then during the winter, you know, we're again based out of Norway, but there's so many competitions throughout the winter and we only have a certain amount of spots on the World Cup. And so guys are going sometimes to the World Cup, sometimes to the level lower. And, you know, we're just trying to do our best and represent our country.
We're talking with Eau Claire natives Andrew Erlob there and Ben Loomis, and they are members of the U.S. national teams, Andrew for ski jumping and Ben for Nordic combined. You can join in with questions and comments along the way. 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. So Andrew, last month you participated in the Ski Flying World Championships in Austria, and I understand this was your first time competing in this world championship. What was the experience like?
Yeah, so I've actually been to three world championship events, but that is on the normal hill and the large hill, which would be a K90 meter hill and a K120 meter hill.
Okay, so can you give us like a comparison, you know, what that would mean? What would that be like?
So the K90 is the same size as Silvermine.
Okay.
If anyone's familiar with that. So the large hill is about, let's say, I don't know, how meters and yards are fairly similar.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit larger than a football field.
Okay, all right.
But flying.
Yeah. So, ski jumping versus flying, what are the different aspects of that and the different techniques?
Exactly. So the Ski Flying World Championships is on a K200 meter hill. So a little less than twice the size of a large hill. And so, yeah, you're flying a much longer way than on a large hill. Yeah, it's actually very similar to ski jumping. A good ski jumper will be a good ski flyer. But of course, everything's happening much faster. Instead of 91 kilometers an hour, you're going 99 to 102 down the in run. So you're going a lot faster. And then, of course, flying a lot further. So it's crazy. First jump ski flying is always, that's where the nerves actually come in. Because, you know, on a ski flying hill, if things don't go well, it's not going to end well. Yeah. But it was a really fun week. And we had some really big crowds. The weather there was honestly not the best. It was really windy, which as an athlete, it creates some challenges. There's a lot of waiting and kind of, you know, not knowing what's going to happen. We had a couple rounds that were canceled due to wind. But they try to make it as safe as possible and as fair as possible as well.
What makes a slope unsafe?
Well, when the wind is either too strong or changing directions very quickly, it's just, you know, when you're flying through the air, that's not really what you want. They want it to be kind of either in one direction, very stable, or just minimal wind, you know. And so when it gets that strong, then it's too dangerous.
Ben, in Nordic combined, how much attention do you pay to the conditions as you in the lead up to a race or in a lead up to an event?
Yeah, so as Andrew said, we obviously have the same factors as wind being the primary issue when it comes to ski jumping, but then on the cross country side too, you're paying a little bit more attention to the snow conditions and temperature. Like for example, just two weekends ago, I was competing in Austria and it was almost 60 degrees. So that's obviously not the best for cross country skiing. It was really deep, slushy snow, which is very doable, but certainly more challenging. So I went from that, you know, 60 degree weight race to a week later competing in Estonia where it was 10 degrees firm. So very big difference. And I think it comes down to just being mentally prepared and being able to adapt to those different conditions.
Yeah. Ben Loomis, Eau Claire native with Andrew Erlob. They are on the Nordic combined team, Ben is, and Andrew is on the U.S. national ski jumping team. As we discuss intense winter sports, call in with a question. What comes up? Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the high-flying, the adrenaline-pumping sport of ski jumping with its long tradition in the Chippewa Valley. A pair of Eau Claire natives compete on the world stage. We have Andrew Erlob on the U.S. national ski jumping team, medaled at last year's U.S. national championships. And two-time Olympian Ben Loomis is here on the U.S. national Nordic combined team. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Christina is here in Glenwood. Christina, hi.
Hi there. Thank you. I'm wondering if you guys started out in gymnastics as kids, or was there any other activity as a child that helped you develop into such amazing athletes?
Christina, thank you. Andrew, was there a gateway sport? Oh, Andrew, I don't know if you're there. How about Ben? Ben, are you there? Was there any gateway for you in ski jumping?
I wouldn't say there was a gateway sport necessarily, but I certainly played a lot of sports growing up, and I did do a little bit of gymnastics, not much, or just as a young kid. But I think most ski jumpers have kind of a broad background of doing a lot of different sports when they grew up. I was spending a lot of time on just various different skis and playing soccer and swimming. And I think all those, I think really any sport can help your progression as an athlete.
And you were on the Flying Eagles Ski Club in Eau Claire. What was that like?
I look back to my kind of younger childhood, and you know, many of my best memories were at the Flying Eagles Ski Club. I spent most of my evenings after school there skiing and jumping and just having fun. So certainly a very good memories of mine, and something I'll always cherish.
Andrew, you were also part of that club in your I think starting at age five, really young. What was it like to really find a sport that you loved?
It actually took me a while to really find my love of ski jumping. I think in the first couple of years, I was finding other sports actually, and of course, going out in the cold and, getting your toes frozen was not always the most enjoyable. And so I think around 11 or 12, when I got opportunities to start traveling across the Midwest and meeting other people, is when I really started to love the sport of ski jumping. And like with Ben, I played many sports throughout elementary and middle school. And yeah, just something really stuck with me with ski jumping. I really enjoyed trying to make it to the next ski jump, to the next biggest one. And just kind of that chase of getting that feeling of moving up and flying further.
We have a follow-up question here from Jeff in Madison, and is wondering, have either of you jumped at Pine Mountain in Iron Mountain, Michigan? And if so, what did you think? As you traveled around the Midwest, Andrew, did you encounter this venue?
Yes, I've been to the Pine Mountain, I think, 3 or 4 times. And actually, on my upcoming schedule, I will be there February, not this weekend, but the following weekend. I think it's like the 23rd, 24th, 25th.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah. What? And so very excited to be back.
You will have some kind of maybe a hometown crew rooting for you, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah. Iron Mountain always has a fantastic crowd. And it's always a blast going up there.
Ben, what local venues for ski jumping attract you?
So similar to Andrew, like I obviously grew up in Eau Claire and traveling around the Midwest, so I've jumped essentially every ski jump in the Midwest. Obviously, Silvermine growing up was Silvermine in Eau Claire was obviously the highlight, being the local competition. I've also jumped Pine Mountain, which is one of my favorite ski jumps. I haven't jumped in a very long time, but certainly very fun. And places like Chicago put on a really good event, and Minneapolis. So there's a lot of cool ski jumps and venues around the Midwest that I grew up jumping on, and certainly many good memories from, and I think set me up for a good career in the sport.
Yeah, let's, you bring up Silvermine, which typically brings you back to Wisconsin this time of year, but the event was canceled for a second consecutive year because officials say the ski slope is unsafe. What are your thoughts on the cancellation? Andrew, you first.
It's really sad. Silvermine has a lot of history in this area. And of course, a lot of kids have very good memories on that hill. And the juniors in our club are, of course, looking forward to competing on that hill. It's a very old ski jump. And our club, is looking to raise money to make the changes on the infrastructure to make it safe again. And so hopefully that will happen in the next couple of years.
So these ski jumps need consistent upkeep and upgrades in order to stay viable?
Yes, when the structure is so high in the air, and the infrastructure is not, you know, safe to walk on, then they have to condemn it to make sure all the athletes participating are safe.
We're talking with Eau Claire natives Andrew Erlob there, Ben Loomis. They are members of the U.S. national teams for ski jumping and Nordic combined. You can join in. Questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Ben, you competed on the U.S. national Nordic combined team for the 2018 and 2022 Olympic Games. Are the 2026 Olympics on your radar?
Yeah, at this point in my career, that's definitely my plan, is to keep competing, keep skiing until at least through the 2026 Olympics. So we're about 2 years out now, so it's definitely coming up quick, and definitely kind of on the forefront of the mind, and yeah, definitely looking to hopefully be attending those as well.
What would you appreciate about Nordic combined being held in Northern Italy?
It will definitely be a change competing in Italy. I mean, more what we're used to. Most of the World Cup competitions we have are in Central Europe or Scandinavia, so it's kind of what we know and what we're used to. With the last two Olympics being Korea and China, those were certainly really awesome experiences, but certainly kind of different and unusual, just not a place we're familiar with or had training on previous to the games. So this will be nice. I've competed in Italy quite a bit already. The jumps, ski jumps will be a little bit different, but I know the area well, so it'll be a little bit more familiar and just kind of a normal event for us, easier to prepare for.
Easier to prepare for. Andrew, is 2026 in your sights?
For sure, yes. I unfortunately just missed out on the 2022 Olympics, so the 2026 are definitely a big goal of mine.
And so a big goal, and do you find yourself thinking about them and really having those preparation steps each competition?
For myself, no. The focus for sure right now is on this season.
Okay. Yeah.
And then, yeah, once it's the Olympic season, then I think that's when preparations will be a bit more geared towards that. But as of right now, yeah, just trying to focus on this season. And we still have about a month and a half left, I believe.
Well, it was great checking in with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you very much for having us.
Yeah, thank you. It was great talking today.
Andrew Erlob is on the U.S. national ski jumping team. Ben Loomis, two-time Olympian, and on the U.S. national Nordic combined team. Both hail from Eau Claire. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin earns an overall failing grade for how it handles tobacco in the state. That's a report by the American Lung Association. We discuss prevention efforts and new research on how to successfully quit tobacco. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tanya Schlamm is an assistant professor in the Department of Kinesiology at UW-Madison and affiliated with the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. Tanya, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks.
Yes, and Molly Collins here as well, Director of Advocacy for the American Lung Association in Wisconsin. Molly, welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning, Molly. Let's start with you. Wisconsin failing 2 out of 5 categories in the association's State of Tobacco Control new report. How do Wisconsin's grades compare to previous years?
You know, Wisconsin has had similar grades in prior years. It's really we haven't done enough as a state to really combat some of these issues that we should be doing, because we know that tobacco is the nation's leading cause of preventable death. And there are some really simple things we could be doing to, adopt policies that help people change their behavior and help people quit smoking.
What are simple things that could make a huge difference in Wisconsin?
Well, one of them is, the Centers for Disease Control has a recommended spending level per state to really address tobacco prevention and cessation and control. And so, we are currently in Wisconsin only budgeting about 10% of what the CDC recommends we spend on tobacco prevention and control work. So, if we want these young people today to never start smoking, never start vaping, then we would be spending more money to help make sure that they understand all of the problems that come with that.
How does Wisconsin compare in these areas of cessation funding and flavored tobacco products and these other areas? How do we compare to other states?
Well, there are states who have moved forward on some of these issues, who, have passed regulations about flavored tobacco products, because we know that those flavors are used to addict young people. Most kids are starting with these, bubblegum flavored vapes and those sorts of things that clearly aren't targeted towards adults. But Wisconsin's state law stops local municipalities from passing ordinances on their own prohibiting those types of products. And our state legislatures has not done anything to address that either.
So legislatively, you're just not seeing the prevention policies advancing in Wisconsin.
Right. There's like a very simple policy that Wisconsin is very behind on other states, which is to raise our legal age of sale for tobacco products to 21, which was signed into law at the federal level by President Trump in 2019. And a number of other states, more than 30, have updated their state laws. Now, it is illegal in Wisconsin for kids to, or for young people to buy tobacco products if they are under 21, but there's a lot of confusion because the state law has not been updated to match the federal law.
Meanwhile, Tanya, you have published a study suggesting people who fail to quit smoking should immediately try again. So based on the research that went into your study, do Wisconsin's grades from the American Lung Association surprise you at all?
Unfortunately, no. It can be somewhat challenging to quit smoking, and it really helps if the policies of the state make it easier and really support it. So, for example, right now, the Wisconsin Tobacco Quitline actually is able to offer 8 weeks of stop smoking medication, but usually, so that's for a limited time, mm-hmm. and usually they can only offer 2 weeks. So offering more stop smoking medication really increases people's ability to quit.
Yeah, the Wisconsin Tobacco Quitline is really lengthening the time for free medications for Wisconsinites from 2 weeks when to 8 weeks. We're talking about tobacco use with Tanya Schlom there at UW-Madison Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. Molly Collins with us at the Wisconsin chapter of the American Lung Association. As we discuss tobacco use, you can call in with questions and comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. So, Molly, Wisconsin made the most improvement in the American Lung Association smoke-free air rating, the state moving from a string of F grades each year since 2017 to a B grade this year. What led to this improvement?
Well, we did pass the smoke-free air law 2015. Mm-hmm. No. We passed a state smoke-free air law 15 years ago, and it's been a really helpful situation in terms of making sure that we're denormalizing tobacco use in our community. And we would love to see, in order to get an A for that smoke-free air law, to extend to nicotine, all tobacco products, so vapes as well being added to that state smoke-free air law. And we also want to see legislators not roll back those protections. So there's currently a bill pending in the state legislature that would allow for more tobacco bars to be created, where 15% of sales would sort of exempt, if 15% of sales were tobacco products, it would exempt them from the state smoke-free air law, and you'd be able to see smoking in taverns again. And so we're really not interested in rolling back those protections. We think we've done significant work to denormalize tobacco use in public places in our state, and we want to keep it that way.
Tanya, what is the success rate for people who tried to quit tobacco use in your study?
So it depended what treatment they got. If 'cause first we offered sort of a basic treatment of 8 weeks of nicotine patch plus around 20 minutes of counseling. And that led to 21% telling us they had quit smoking at 6 months.
21% had quit smoking in 6 months. You know, what did you find that was the most helpful to them for not relapsing? Was it the nicotine patches? Was it the counseling? Was it something else?
People tell us that they love the patch. They find it really helpful for dealing with cravings. But we know from the research that the combination of getting some counseling plus some medication is really what works best. And the quit line will actually, so you can call them as much as you'd like for free coaching. It's 1-800-QUIT-NOW, or you can text or go to wiquitline.org. And they offer both the coaching and the medication. But based on the research, the very best two medications rise above the rest. One would be a combination nicotine replacement therapies. So that means both a nicotine patch plus some oral nicotine, mm-hmm. like gum or mini lozenges, or Chantix.
And Chantix is a prescription. Is that right?
Correct. Yes.
Tanya Schlamm is an assistant professor in UW-Madison's Department of Kinesiology, led a new study about people who attempt to quit smoking. Molly Collins is with us, advocacy director at the American Lung Association in Wisconsin. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin receives failing marks for tobacco prevention funding and a lack of restrictions on flavored tobacco products in a new report by the American Lung Association. We examine efforts to end tobacco use in our state, and you can be part of the conversation. Call in with the question, share your view at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Molly Collins with us, Advocacy Director at the American Lung Association in Wisconsin. And Tanya Schlamm is an assistant professor in UW-Madison's Department of Kinesiology and affiliate of the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. Let's go to Sean in Oshkosh. Sean, hi.
Yes, hello, everybody. Thank you for taking my call. I was a longtime smoker, although it was light. I do still currently vape. However, getting good quality products has really helped me and my health and overall. But that is not why I was calling. I was calling because if the problem is funding, I'd like to know why aren't we using the funding that's coming from all this illegal gambling? And I call it illegal gambling because although it's allowed in certain places, it's highly restricted and it seems hypocritical. But that has a much greater addictive impact on our society as equal to cigarettes. Or why don't we legalize marijuana, use those monies combined, maybe tax the alcohol industry more so that we can fund real supportive wellness programs in Wisconsin.
Sean, thank you for the call. Molly, looking at possible revenue streams, what do you see?
Well, I think, you know, Sean, it would be awesome for you to contact your elected officials and share your thoughts about how we should be spending our state funds and the revenues that we're generating through various mechanisms. I think, you know, we really need lawmakers to understand that, you know, spending money on prevention and helping people quit saves us so much money in healthcare costs in the long run. You mentioned that, you know, our report finds that the healthcare costs due to smoking in Wisconsin are over $2 billion. And we really want to make sure that we're helping people live their healthiest lives. And so I think, you know, by investing in helping people quit smoking, making sure the Quitline can provide those 8 weeks of treatment and 8 weeks of medication, that really makes a big difference for people's success rates. And so I think, you know, we really need to think about sort of the long-term benefits of these investments in the near future.
Tanya, what do you think about in terms of funding the Wisconsin Tobacco Quitline?
Yes, so I did a study with Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. We found 26 weeks of nicotine patch plus nicotine gum was even more effective than 8 weeks. So really, you know, the more the better, and if you need it for longer, ask your doctor, but it is much better to be on stop smoking medication in general than to be smoking combustible tobacco. So really giving people the support, both at the policy level and at the individual level, can really help.
Tanya, what do you find people do when they run out of the free medications?
So we saw, you know, we graphed it and we just saw a big dip when the medication stops. This was in our study. So at either 8 weeks or 26 weeks, we just saw it drop off. So we tried to encourage people to get it on their own, but you know, it's easier when it's free and they'll mail it directly to you the way that the Quitline will.
It's very much accessible and when it comes right to you, and also the cost, you don't have that cost to burden in your budget, which I could imagine would be quite costly, Tanya.
Right, exactly. Basically, health behavior change, any change can be challenging. And the more we can smooth the way, the fewer clicks, the more likely people are to do it.
Tania Schlamm there at UW-Madison Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. Molly Collins is with us at the Wisconsin chapter of the American Lung Association as we talk about tobacco use, curbing tobacco use in our state. Call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Molly, one of the categories Wisconsin failed is tobacco cessation and prevention funding, as we've been talking about. How is the state evaluated for a grade in this category?
Well, we just know that, you know, as was mentioned, providing people with longer amounts of medication that's available, making sure that they can speak to counselors if they need to, you know, have phone calls, supportive coaching, all of those things help increase people's ability to quit smoking or quit vaping. And so we want to make sure that all of those things are available to folks. And that just, you know, it may take people a few times, right? Like we all know people who smoke and who have been trying to quit, and it may take them a few times, but they need to be able to keep trying. They need to be able to call back and get more medication and just make sure that they're really able to, you know, completely access everything they need to help them stop smoking, because that mm-hmm. will benefit all of us in the long term.
Let's bring in Jody in Oregon. Jody, hi.
Hi. My concern was the cost of the nicotine patch, anywhere from $28 to $43. I realize that the state gives you about three of those, but then you're cut off. That's it. And I think the cost of these patches is a deterrent for somebody trying to start out when they're looking at those expenses.
Jody, thank you so much for sharing those costs. Tania, do you hear Jody's concerns in your research?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, one nice thing about a research study is that we're able to offer the medication at no cost. And the quit line can offer it, but generally only 2 weeks. So this is a real issue that needs to be addressed.
What about quitting cold turkey, as we heard of, you know, before? Does that have a greater or lesser tendency for relapse, Tania?
Yes. So quitting cold turkey, you are decreasing your chances of success. We know the best way is to use both stop smoking medicine and coaching. And it really looks like making sure to use the medication adherently. So if you're using, say, nicotine mini lozenges, to use enough a day to really help the cravings and to wear the patch for enough hours. If it's not bothering you, some people even wear it 24 hours. Again, there with using enough mini lozenges, for example, it's helpful to have those available free. Basically, it is worth it to society to have its population healthy and not, you know, if you smoke, your children or are more likely to smoke as well. So to not be encouraging the next generation to start.
Tania Schlamm, assistant professor in the UW-Madison Department of Kinesiology, lead author of this new study about people who try to quit tobacco. Molly Collins heads up advocacy for the American Lung Association in Wisconsin. Call in with a question, share thoughts, 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As the Wisconsin Tobacco Quit Line expands access to free medications for residents offering 8 weeks of items like nicotine patches instead of two, we discuss how Wisconsin is trying to curb tobacco use and a new report card from the American Lung Association. Call in with a question. You can share your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tanya Schlamm is an assistant professor and faculty affiliate of the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. Molly Collins is here, American Lung Association's advocacy director in Wisconsin. Molly, we heard from Matt in Madison who says, look, the answer is simple. The Food and Drug Administration should quit selling people things known to kill us. And Matt says, stop selling toxic things to Americans. How could the federal government be more aggressive on the policy front?
Yeah, the Lung Association has been calling on the Food and Drug Administration to increase their oversight and scrutiny of these products. We think that will help protect children. It will help protect adults. And again, you know, we don't think we should, you know, risk losing another generation to tobacco-caused diseases as the result of, you know, the expansion of e-cigarettes or vapes. And we're really troubled by the fact that they haven't moved to address the problem of flavors, especially menthol in combustible tobacco products. We know that menthol, you know, makes it easier to smoke, helps people breathe more tobacco smoke and more cancer-causing smoke into their lungs. And we know that, like, taking those products off the market would save a lot of lives. And so it's important that we start addressing that through the powers that Congress has given the FDA.
Tanya, the makers of Juul e-cigarettes say their product is an alternative to combustible cigarettes. Are e-cigarettes or vapes a good alternative to combustible cigarettes?
So what the United Kingdom has come down on is that they recommend both stop smoking medication and or e-cigarettes to people who want to quit smoking. In the United States, people haven't been willing to recommend that in terms of especially wanting to prevent youth from thinking, you know, normalizing e-cigarettes and making them think that they're safe, because we don't know that they're safe. Most scientists feel comfortable saying that it's a safer alternative. And the UK feels comfortable saying that it's a reduced harm activity. So better than combustibles, but not necessarily safe. We don't have research to support that.
How does your research differentiate vaping and smoking?
So we ask about it, mm-hmm. and as new studies start, we also check whether people have quit both vaping and smoking, or just smoking.
Molly mentioned how menthol cigarettes make it both easier to start and harder to quit. And I'm wondering, what does menthol do to someone that you know, accelerates this tobacco addiction, Tanya?
Well, one thing a lot of people don't realize is that cigarettes and e-cigarettes have sugar in them. And of course, you know, sugar and flavoring, it's just rewarding for us. We enjoy it, and especially children. And so it makes it less harsh and less unpleasant.
Wow. Let's take another call now. Ross in Soldiers Grove. Ross, hi.
Hi, good morning. It seems like the study of nicotine addiction and maybe just addiction in general is really getting to the heart of the human predicament. I mean, of all the sort of things about humanity and stuff, understanding what it is about our addictions. And it seems like, I'll say cigarette smoking or nicotine addiction really just seems like it just seems so fundamental, kind of like how we are and what we do. But anyhow, so, you know, and I think you guys kind of asked the question because in my mind, it seems that.
Oh, Ross, you're breaking up a bit. Are you still there?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you just ask your question? You're just breaking up a bit.
Okay. Sorry. So goal is less lung cancer and less emphysema. It seems as if vaping as still an addiction would at least solve that problem, let's just say halfway. And I guess it sounds like the research is still, because it's so early, that there might not be enough research as to how bad it really is.
Yeah, Ross, thank you for that. Molly, is there any ability for vaping to be able to get someone to end nicotine addiction?
I think, you know, the mid to long-term consequences of e-cigarettes or vaping, they're not, we don't know. It's a pretty new product to the market. They've only been sold for about a decade in the United States. And so we don't know about the long-term lasting health consequences of those products. But we do know that, you know, if they want to be considered a cessation product, a product that helps people quit smoking, then there's a process for that review by the FDA to say, we should be, you know, looked at like we are, you know, the same sort of cessation medication that the patch is. And so, you know, I think when they've been through that review process, then I think we'd be really comfortable recommending that. But until they go through that review and we know that there aren't the same long-term, you know, health consequences like lung cancer and COPD, I don't think we'd be willing to recommend that. We recommend folks use the approved medications to quit smoking.
Molly Collins with us at the Wisconsin chapter of the American Lung Association, and Tanya Schlamm at UW-Madison Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. Call in with questions and comments along the way about tobacco use in our state, 800-642-1234. Nancy is here in Grafton. Nancy, hello.
Well, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, you know what? The sun is going to shine again. Well, anyhow, what I wanted to tell you was that my husband, when he was a little fellow, his folks had a tavern, and they had living quarters in the back of the tavern. Anyhow, so he had access to cigarettes very young, and he smoked them and smoked them. And, oh, we got married, and we had kids and everything, and he was in his 40s, and oh, all of a sudden he said, gosh, darn it, something, I don't know, it hurts my chest. And so went to the hospital. Oh, you had a heart attack. So they did some surgery, and then he came home, and he took his cigarettes, and he threw them away, and he never smoked another cigarette in his life. So I was so happy. I said that was the best doggone thing that ever could have happened, was to throw those doggone cigarettes away.
Nancy, thank you for sharing such a personal story. And Tanya, there is that generational aspect that you talked about before of someone growing up around cigarettes in the back of a tavern.
Yes, we really find, you know, we are such visual creatures. If you can see the smoking cues, if you have easy access, it's going to make it much more likely as a curious teenager, or sometimes, unfortunately, even younger, that you'll try it because it's right there. And that's one reason we need to, you know, get smoking and vaping out of movies, out of school bathrooms, just not visible, not acceptable, not accessible. So also laws like tobacco 21 where you can't buy it legally unless you're 21 or helpful. And I was just going to say, what a great story. I'm so glad he quit. And there is this interesting finding that even if someone very close to you has a heart attack due to smoking, it's actually, we only see the dramatic quit rates when someone themselves experiences a heart attack. So we want to keep trying to find ways for people not to have to personally experience a severe health condition in order to find the strength to quit, but to provide more support so it's easier and cheaper to quit without needing to have a heart attack.
Yes, yes. Molly, you know, Tanya mentions age 21. What is the American Lung Association trying to do in terms of, you know, the use of tobacco and the age?
Yeah, well, we just know that it is, you know, like we want kids to stop being able to purchase tobacco products. And you know, we've seen an increase in the number of youth sales. And that's just, you know, kids under the age of 18 being able to buy tobacco products like e-cigarettes or cigars or vape products. And so we really want to, you know, create the climate where retailers understand that it is totally illegal for them to sell products to kids or to any individual who's under 21. We need to make sure that that understanding is shared by our retailer community, because I know that, you know, they're not trying to, you know, start and maintain addictions in children, but we know that huge numbers of middle school and high school kids are using these products, and we really need to do something about that.
Molly Collins there, Director of Advocacy for the American Lung Association in Wisconsin. Tanya Schlamm is an assistant professor in the Department of Kinesiology at UW-Madison, lead author of a new study on smoking relapse. Call in with a question. You can add your situation, your perspective, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As the American Lung Association releases its grades for Wisconsin's tobacco control policies, we discuss efforts to eliminate tobacco use. And you can call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Molly Collins is Advocacy Director for the American Lung Association in Wisconsin, and Tanya Schlamm is an assistant professor in UW-Madison's Department of Kinesiology, lead author of a study on smoking relapse. Liz is here in Lyons. Liz, hi, go ahead.
Hi. My fiancé has been smoking since he was 9, so that makes it 30 years, and he has tried every single stop smoking measure in the world, including the medication Chantix. Is there anything new or different that he could try to stop him from relapsing, I guess you would say, into smoking again?
Liz, thank you for sharing. Tanya, is there anything else out there that this person can try?
Yes. Yeah, so first off, it's wonderful that he wants to quit and that he continues to work on it, and that you're so supportive, because that's really helpful as well. I'd really encourage him to call the quit line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW. They don't have a time limit, actually. they will just talk to him and he could really analyze, you know, what has he learned from these quit attempts? What has he learned that works? What is it that seems to trip him up? And, you know, make like quite a detailed plan in terms of which medications seem most effective, which strategies. There's this great quote from the Tips from Former Smokers ads, which really drive people to want to quit. And they say, do whatever it takes, no matter how many times it takes. We did it. You can too. Mm. So I really do believe that anybody can quit. It just may require additional problem solving and support and just kind of sticking with it.
Tanya, I wonder, are quitting techniques different for each individual? Does each person need their own plan?
Yes, there are certainly general principles that really, really help, like having your home and car, if you have one, being smoke-free. But for example, many people find that stopping drinking alcohol for a little while they're getting their abstinence from smoking established can be very helpful, or having a limit, only drinking one or two drinks. There are definitely principles, but also you really need to analyze your life and what works for you and what trips you up. And talking to someone else with experience, like at the Quit Line, can really help and also give people hope. Another thing that often trips people up is kind of, especially if you've been drinking, thinking, oh, I'll just have one puff. What's the harm? You know, everything in moderation. But we know that having one puff can often sort of spell the end of the quit attempt. So I worked with someone who he would tell himself, it's just not an option. Smoking is just not an option. And he found that worked for him.
We have an email here from Linda and is wondering if you can run the numbers for us. Compare the costs of like smoking cessation medications like nicotine patches, the lozenges, the Chantix, compared to the cost of buying cigarettes and feeding an addiction like this. Molly, can you weigh in on those costs?
I don't have those types of numbers available, but I will just say that the state quit line, our investment per smoker is only about a dollar. And the median investment per smoker is, you know, for the whole country is $1.93. So we're spending about half of what many states are spending, and maybe even less than that per smoker to help folks. And so I think, you know, we could increase that investment and see even better results. And I will pass it over to Tanya to see if she has any thoughts about the overall costs of cessation attempt and medication.
Tanya, what are the financial impacts here?
I do know that whatever intervention we do that's effective to help people quit smoking, it's always, when you do the analyses, it's always cost effective to help somebody quit because the health effects can be so expensive. But there are lots of stop smoking apps. You can find one at our website, the Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention, and they will calculate for you how much you would save during different periods of time if you had quit. You enter how much your cigarettes cost, and they'll calculate that for you. But because, you know, cigarettes are an ongoing cost, that never goes away unless you quit. Whereas stop smoking medication, most people, unfortunately, you know, we'd actually like them to use it for longer, but most people only use it somewhat briefly. It's much, much cheaper.
Tanya, you know, you have this new research recently published on relapse. What are you focusing on next?
Great question. I did a study looking at, it was a small pilot study looking at using mobile games to quit smoking, to help with quitting smoking, along with stop smoking medication and coaching. And we found that people really liked playing solitaire and found that helpful, always in their pocket to distract from urges to smoke. So I'm hoping to do a bigger study looking at that.
Phones and technology could be another avenue. And Molly, briefly, what is the most important thing for Wisconsin to focus on right now in this area?
You know, I think for our listeners, just making sure that they understand that tobacco use, even though it might look different, might be smoking, might be e-cigarettes or vaping, you know, it's still here with us. The tobacco industry is still trying to keep people addicted and addict new customers. And so it's an issue that we should be thinking about and talking to our elected officials about, and making sure that folks are supported in stopping and never starting.
Molly and Tanya, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Molly Collins is Director of Advocacy for the American Lung Association in Wisconsin. Tanya Schlamm, Assistant Professor in the Department of Kinesiology at UW-Madison and affiliate of the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. If you or someone you know is trying to quit, the Wisconsin Tobacco Quit Line is at 800-QUIT-NOW. That's 800-784-8669. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.